As the weather warms up, you might spot more outdoor cats in your neighborhood. For pet owners, raising a cat to be indoor versus outdoor is a very sensitive subject. There have even been passionate debates on the subject on the staff of this show. A book has fueled the indoor-outdoor cat debate by calling for the removal of all outdoor cats by any means necessary. I talked a while back about the ethics of cat ownership with Barbara King, emerita professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She also writes about animal issues for NPR. I asked her if we know for sure that cats are better off inside.
Well, we here in our home in Virginia have made the decision to keep cats indoors because it is safer for them, and it's also safer for birds and small mammals. I know that some people feel very strongly that their cats are unhappy indoors or penned up indoors, but I think the cost-benefit ratio for both the cats and for other animals really tips us towards trying very hard to keeping cats indoors. Or, you know, there's ways to enclose them outdoors. There's cat patios that are called catios. There's all kinds of ingenious solutions now so that cats can get a bit of fix of the outdoors but not be in danger themselves or a danger to others.
Well, now, on Second Thought, producer Sean Powers talked with his former neighbor, Jessica. They have a cat named Gatsby who spends nights outside, days inside. Jessica told Sean that she has considered getting a Fitbit for Gatsby so that she can track his every move. And Jessica has also said that Gatsby has brought back some surprises from his adventures outdoors.
He's caught, you know, the usual chipmunks, birds. He caught a fish once from a little creek, a tiny snake, I think a lizard. You know, he's a friendly creature. He's not hurting anyone else's pets. He's not hurting people. And, you know, cats came from the outside. You know, they're naturally outdoor creatures.
Now, Barbara, I suppose that we're all naturally outdoor creatures and we're all naturally predatory. But do we know if cats cause any kind of significant environmental damage? We know about the anecdotes. We see them coming back with, you know, mice and rodents all the time, little presents. But do they actually hurt the urban and suburban environments that they inhabit?
Yeah, that's the question at hand. First, I don't think we're all predatory. By the way, there's lots of species that are not. But anyway,
I meant humans. Sorry.
Okay, I think it's really important for even the strongest cat advocates to admit that, yes, cats do negatively impact bird populations and small mammals. So I think the question is more to what degree, and then, of course, what do we do about it? One thing I really dislike strongly is the discourse that is going around that cats are vicious predators. In fact, of course, they just evolved to be predators, and this is in their nature. This does not mean that we need to take drastic steps to eradicate them. Now, I have talked to scientists who are biologists and ornithologists, and they give me one set of numbers about the impact of cats on other wildlife. And I talk to people who are urban ecologists and cat advocates, and they give me another set of numbers. I think right now we're not really on solid ground with some of these extremely sensational projections about cats killing literally billions of birds. I think a lot of small studies have been greatly overgeneralized and that we don't actually have good science on the impact. But the question for me is not, I mean, the numbers are important and we need to nail them down, but we need to really remember that we're talking about animals here who deserve a chance at life, that the answer is not to eradicate cats, but to work together to reduce cat populations in really humane ways so that we can love these cats and not demonize them.
What would those humane ways be?
Well, first of all, of course, TNR. TNR stands for trap, neuter, and return. And just like it sounds, cats are taken from the community. These may be feral cats that are completely unsocialized or stray cats that are homeless at the moment but are more socialized. They're spayed and they're neutered and they're returned to the place where they were living in some kind of community colony. And the cat wars rhetoric that's going around is that TNR is a big failure. And this is not, in fact, accurate according to either my reading or my own personal experience. TNR that's going to be successful requires a lot of community resources, time, and effort. And the thing that I like to really emphasize is that nobody that I know who's a cat advocate is suggesting that we need lots and lots more of feral and stray cats. This is clearly not our goal. We want fewer feral and stray cats, and we want to work to reduce their population numbers. But we can do this without alarmist and sensational rhetoric, or, by the way, without suggesting that there's necessarily a war at hand. You know, the rhetoric is that there's only two possibilities. Either you love cats and you don't care about birds, or you love birds and you don't care about cats. And this is the first starting point. We need to reject that kind of rhetoric and realize that we can think sensibly and take steps to really protect birds. This is very important. And also at the same time, not to ramp up this really violent rhetoric against cats.
That's Barbara King, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary. She also writes about animal behavior for NPR. Barbara, thank you so much. So much for cats for now. But behind the concrete walls of the Fulton County Jail, inmates are hard at work training dogs. The Canine Cellmates program pairs inmates with rescue dogs who train the animals so that they can become adoptable. They sleep, eat, and play with their four-legged companions for 9 to 12 weeks. CCM, as the program is called, is in its fifth year of supporting inmates and giving shelter dogs a home. On Second Thought, producer Summer Evans went behind the walls to see how these inmates and dogs bond, and she brought back this audio postcard.
Susan Jacob Bose. I'm director of Canine Cellmates, the jail dogs program in Fulton County Jail. Most programs that involve incarcerated persons and dogs are inside of prisons. This is a jail, and that is challenging of its own accord because the physical structure of a jail is not usually conducive to having dogs. Jails are meant for short-term holding, and so usually if they're an urban jail like Fulton County, they're a high-rise, which is very difficult to try to house dogs in.
My name is John Kendall. I'm an inmate at Fulton County Jail and a member of the Canine Cellmates Dog Program. This cycle I have Chewbacca. We have a Star Wars theme in this cycle, so they're all named after characters from Star Wars movie. And if you see Chewie, there's nothing else we could have named him but Chewbacca.
My name is Jeanette Holloway, and I'm the lead trainer for the Canine Cellmate Program at Fulton County Jail.
What's great about Chewy, he's we're pretty sure he's close to being as purebred as they can get from the shelter, and he's a Leon Burger, which is a mix between St. Bernards, Newfoundlands, and Great Pyrenees, three breeds. They're noted for their lioness features. When he's off-leash, he's playful and jumps around and high energy, but you put a leash on him and he immediately goes to work, which those three breeds are known for. They're all rescue breeds, water and land rescue breeds.
Be patient, slow it down. 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 Good boy. Here we go. Touch. Good boy. Here we go.
I was arrested for drug trafficking heroin. And most of the guys here have minor charges. Mine is a little bit more serious. But seeing guys come and go from cycle to cycle, it really changed my thinking. You know, everyone says that, you know, a drug charge is a victimless crime. But when you see these guys come in here and they're drug addicted, it really changes the way you think about, you know, your actions and how they affect others.
The pride that they have in themselves, passing that dog over to a new family, knowing it's going to be safe and well taken care of, and on top of that, that they've trained that dog to behave accordingly for that new family, it's gut-slamming. I mean, it just fills the room. They're excited and they're emotional, but they're really proud of themselves. I think for a lot of them, sometimes it could be that it's the first time they saw anything through to the finish line.
The city of Atlanta is very lucky to have a program like this and to have Susan and her volunteers. Small miracles happen here every single day, every day. And they should be thankful for Susan, because she and her volunteers, they're saving lives, you know, one man and one dog at a time.
Sit. Watch me.
Good job, guys.
That audio postcard was produced by On Second Thoughts' Summer Evans. The next Canine Cellmates dog graduation is May 4th. For more information on how you can volunteer or help with this program, visit gpbnews.org. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Poetry is not always about love and happiness, as my colleague on the Mercer University faculty, Anya Silver, can tell you. Her poetry deals often with depression, fear, and living with cancer. But her latest collection, Second Bloom, is also about life and joy. And here's something that I know for a fact she's quite joyful about. Silver has just been awarded a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. That's a big deal. This honor pays tribute to mid-career scholars, artists, and scientists. Silver talked about her writing with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley.
Well, it's good to have you back. And I was interested from the very beginning, you chose to start the book with a quote from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it says, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of countenance the heart is made glad." And I wonder, why did you start with a quote that says sorrow is better than laughing?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think that when people go through sorrow or trauma of some sort, they grow in a way that they might not if their lives were completely happy. And it's possible to gain wisdom from that. But also that if you experience sorrow, you truly understand the moments of joy and happiness in a new and more vibrant way. So that quote in Ecclesiastes has always spoken to me for that reason.
One of your poems said that when you're sad, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was said when you're sad, you read the Psalms. Why?
Yes. I find the Psalms incredibly comforting. The celebratory Psalms remind me of the beauty of life, and that sort of ennobles my life. And the poems about suffering make me feel less alone, and I realize that I'm not the only person in the world going through something painful, and that there's a whole community of people who are going through difficult times, and that sense of community is really valuable to me. And just in general, the idea that there is a God to whom I can speak, whether it's in happiness or anger, is something that sustains me.
So, as always, your poetry is very honest and straightforward. And I was struck by the very first poem. You sort of lay it out, and there's a couple lines in there where you say, "I don't know why I'm still alive," which sort of hit me like a dagger. And you follow it with, "I don't know how a line of poetry sometimes loses itself and finds me." And I wondered, you're basically beginning your book of poetry by saying, "I'm not sure why poetry has power over me," in a way.
Right.
How come?
Well, it's always been a mystery to me how I write poetry. And I'm not saying this in any sort of self-aggrandizing way, but sometimes I feel like poetry comes from the outside, comes from something transcendent. And it's always a miracle to me when I think of a line of poetry, not knowing whether it's coming from just my neurons firing or whether there's some transcendent force, what God or the divine or the universe or whatever working through me. And it's the same thing about life. I don't know why I'm alive and why my friends have died. There's no reason for that. It just is. And dealing with why that is, well, there's no answer for it. I have to deal with it. It's just what I cope with and think about every day.
Well, let's go back to this issue of the divine, because it comes up a lot in this new book of poetry. And I want to read a couple lines that struck me, because you, in many poems, you seem to be sort of having a conversation with the divine. And at the end of one, you say, "Merciful one, begotten of woman, understand how difficult it is to trust that you are kind."
Yeah, that's one of my anger poems. Well, you know, I was raised in the Christian faith, and I'm still a Christian. And so we're raised with this idea of the ever-loving, omnipotent God. And that, to me, has always been really theologically a problem, because I don't—and, of course, it has been for so many people, because I don't know why a loving God would allow a young woman with children to die a horrible death. And so in that poem, I was thinking about a very good friend of mine who died, and she had two children. And it was Christmas, and we were thinking about the goodness of God and Christ. And I was thinking, well, what's the proof that God is good in the world? What's the proof that God loves us when we see people around us suffering? And I didn't really have an answer for that. So I was just telling God, well, sometimes I don't really trust you. I don't know what you're thinking. I guess I believe in a faith that has room for anger toward God and questioning of God. And I don't feel like that's incompatible with being a person of faith.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author, poet, and Mercer English professor Anya Silver. And then the second section of the book, I mean, you mentioned Christmas. The second section mm-hmm. is centered around holidays, Christmas,
right, right.
New Year's, Lent, mm-hmm. Easter. And it occurred, you know, I was thinking about it as I read these poems, that especially when you have kids, those holidays are really important. Like, those are the mile
yeah.
markers that create right. your memories of childhood, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, right.
And that was my question. I said, I wonder if that's where this comes from. Like, these holidays become sort of the mile markers. These are the places that allow you to sort of count the passage of time.
Right. Well, in the Episcopal Church, we have long periods of time that are called ordinary time, but then we also have these periods of Lent and holidays. And I'm a very ritualistic person, and so I really organize my life around certain holidays and certain mile markers like birthdays or Christmas or Easter. And those are always the times that appear most strongly in my memory and that I try to live most consciously. And there are also the times when I talk to women who are sick that the women want to live for. They say, I want to make it to the next Christmas. I want to make it to the next Easter. There's just a way in which those holidays give us a sense of time in our lives when time is so amorphous. And it also makes those holidays difficult because it puts so much weight on them. We feel so much pressure for those days to be perfect and to survive us in memory.
I wonder if you would read a poem for me. I think it's from the third section. It's called Noah.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, the name, your son's name, I mean, since we're speaking about faith mm-hmm. and speaking about the Bible, obviously your son's named after a very important
right.
man of faith from the Bible, which to me made the poem itself all that more poignant. Would you read it for us?
Do you mean the Psalm for Noah?
Yes, Psalm for Noah.
Yes, okay. Yes, this is Psalm 137 for Noah, and it's based on Psalm 137. Psalm 137 for Noah. Come, darling, sit by my side and weep. I have no lyre, no melodious voice or chant. I meditate on the Zion I could never grant you. My son, my roe deer, my rock rent stream, my honeysuckle, my salt, my golden spear. Forgive me your birth in this strange land. I wanted your infant caresses, your fists clasped around my neck. I craved you, though you were born in the wake of my illness, my dim prognosis. I was selfish. I willed you this woe, this world. You inherited exile for my sake.
So there are conflicting thoughts going on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
It sounds as though you feel in a way guilty that you brought this child into the world knowing that you may not be there to see all his future birthdays.
Yes. I was diagnosed originally with cancer in 2004 when I was pregnant, and my son is really the joy of my life. I mean, I feel so lucky to have him. But there is always this guilt. And I think all parents probably feel this to some degree when they see terrible things happening in the world. But there's always the sense of guilt for me that if something terrible happens to me, if I die young, that I will have brought him pain in bringing him life. And I question to myself whether it's right to bring a child into the world when you guarantee that child pain. But the thing is, that's the case for everybody. I mean, everybody who has children knows that their child is going to suffer, and we just have to, I guess, in my case, I decided that the joy of life and the beauty and connection of life were more important than the chances of suffering. But it's certainly something I think about a lot, and I do feel some guilt about it.
Do you talk with him about that?
No, not specifically.
But he's read the poem.
I don't know if he has. He probably will after this broadcast.
Because he's what, 14, 13?
He's 13, and we do talk about it. I haven't talked to him about this because I don't want him to sense that I have any regrets about his birth, which, of course, I don't. But being a parent just comes with so many conflicting emotions, and it's so intense and overwhelming. And sometimes we do have these feelings that we don't like to talk about. And I wanted to just be completely honest with the fact that I felt them, even though when I said to people sometimes, oh, it was wrong to have a child considering my health, they are shocked and upset that I would say that. But I think it's something that people feel, and I just wanted to be honest about it.
Well, you are incredibly honest, and your poetry always has been, as I mentioned, but I wanted to read another section from a poem because one of the things that struck me is how often it sounds like you're saying, I don't know how to make poetry out of what's happening to me,
right,
while you're making poetry out of what's happening to you.
Right.
So there's a part where you say, today when I could be writing, I sit waiting mm-hmm. for a nurse to access me, that is, puncture me with a needle. I cannot work because of the talk, the cold room, the television's jabber, the microwave smells of grease and burn. I want words, but my mind stalls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you do that? I mean, you are addressing some, very, in some cases, prosaic. You curse mm-hmm. a couple times in the poetry.
Yes, I do. I'm sorry. Well, one thing that I've on the one hand, cancer has been this mine of amazing subject matter for me, just like, you know, my family has and my husband has been. But on the other hand, it takes so much time to be a patient. It takes so much time to be ill. Anatole Breuer, who wrote for the New York Times, or the New Yorker, I'm sorry, said that patients are the best people at waiting because we learn to just spend huge amounts of our time waiting. And so sometimes I do resent my illness and resent my body for getting in the way of me being able to write. So I resent the fact my body is too tired to write or that my mind is too tired. And sometimes I worry that that will keep poetry from it will keep me from writing poetry, and I just have to trust that poetry is this mother tongue that will come back to me despite the fact that my body sometimes feels like it's failing me, and I do feel a lot of hostility towards my body for preventing me from doing what I want to do.
What is the benefit in presenting these very uncomfortable images for people, presenting to them these very, mm-hmm. in some cases, frustrating and in some cases upsetting images into poetry?
Well, I think that as a culture, we are very illness phobic. We don't talk about it a lot. We're very death phobic. And I want to resist that narrative and to be able to speak honestly about the difficulties of life, both for people who are experiencing it and might feel alone in their experiencing, and also for people who haven't experienced it so that they can understand what it's like to feel this pain and uncertainty. So I think that good writing has to be honest. And if it's not completely honest, then it's not living up to what it could do. And so there are poems that I write that I wouldn't publish, but for me, there should be nothing taboo in terms of writing about, because a writer's job is to bring the truth to the world, his or her truth. And if my truth is uncomfortable for people, then that isn't really my problem. My job is to bring my truth to the world, and my truth isn't always pretty.
And yet it's this, for me at least as a reader, it occupies an odd space because it's mm-hmm. escapist for me because the writing is beautiful and it is the opposite of escapist.
Right.
Because it is extremely real. This is about death and mm-hmm. life and what you choose with these moments. And in one of the poems you describe being at a meeting, a real meeting. Mm-hmm. In which you mentioned cancer and everyone kind of looks away. And the reason I know that it's real is because when I posted that poem on Facebook, somebody wrote, I was at that meeting.
Oh, goodness. Uh-oh. Yeah, it's people are just so uncomfortable with illness. And the thing is, I'm not uncomfortable talking about it. I'm not uncomfortable joking about it. I'm not really uncomfortable with death. I think death is just a natural part of the human process. And there's a poem I have called Nocturne in which I refer to withered petals alongside sumptuous ruffles. Well, you wouldn't have the sumptuous ruffles of joy and belonging and life if you didn't have those withered petals. You can't have one without the other. And so I have a tremendous amount of joy in my life, and my joy coexists with pain. I don't see those two things as completely separate. I think all of life is woven together, and separating the strands is impossible. So I'm comfortable talking about those things and still being a happy person.
That's poet and Mercer University English professor Anya Silver speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. Her latest book of poetry is Second Bloom, and Silver has just been awarded a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. Kyler Brownville is one of Savannah's oldest African-American neighborhoods. It earned its official historic status 2 decades ago, but since then, more than 100 historic properties have been demolished. Can historic designation actually encourage demolitions? That's a counterintuitive thing, but it's something people talk about. I talked about this with Daniel Carey. He's president and CEO of the Historic Savannah Foundation. And we were also joined by Amy Bragg, president of Preservation Detroit. Daniel, just briefly tell us a little bit about this neighborhood in Savannah.
It's about a half square mile, bordered by MLK and Ogeechee Road and Victory Drive. And 37th Street. It's traditionally working class African Americans. A lot of them worked in the Central of Georgia Railroad shops up the way a little bit. And is a great representative neighborhood for vernacular architecture and just good, solid working class housing.
What kind of houses? I mean, describe things for us.
Well, as you pointed out, historically, they're late 19th, early 20th century, wood frame, very small, modest cottages, but a number of shotguns as well. And as you said, the area was listed in the National Register of Historic Places, and it has local designation as well, both important.
Sure. So does the Savannah is obviously, you know, one of the great national success stories in historic preservation, and yet that success has not come without struggle, even in the most elite fancy neighborhoods of Savannah that were inhabited by very, very wealthy people, generally white people, slave-owning people. When we look at historic African-American neighborhoods, are there particular preservation challenges there?
I really don't think they're any different. There was plenty of blight in downtown Savannah back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the same in the Victorian District, same in Thomas Square. And that is what we're just really fully recognizing and addressing now in the late 20th century, early 21st century in Kyler Brownville. It's just taken a while to get there. But Kyler Brownville doesn't look that much different than downtown looked 50 years ago.
Amy Bragg with Preservation Detroit, how is what you're hearing about in Savannah compared to your experiences doing preservation in Detroit?
Well, it's a pretty similar set of challenges, although Detroit has, you know, unique historical reasons for struggling with some of the blight and demolition that we've seen in recent years. Detroit was hit very hard by the recession in 2009 and is still in many areas struggling to recover. We find that historic districts tended to weather that recession a little better. Property values tended to stay more stable in those neighborhoods, and the integrity of the buildings tended to hold up pretty well. But, you know, Detroit is still struggling with economic woes, and homeowners still find it difficult to maintain their properties in some cases. So that's true in both, you know, relatively well-to-do neighborhoods as well as it is in more economically depressed areas. So, you know, in the same vein, the city is working on a really massive blight removal campaign that's been underway for the past several years. The city is on track to demolish as many as 10,000 houses in the next 2 years. And that, you know, in the preservation community, there are concerns about that. Certainly, there are a number of blighted structures that are too far gone to save and present, you know, safety hazards and quality of life issues in neighborhoods. But that can also lead to kind of a massive demolition first strategy that, you know, we have concerns could lead to the loss of historic integrity that is really hard to bring back once you tear it down.
There can't even be resistance among the residents of a neighborhood to having their neighborhood be designated officially historic. Tell us about this sort of landowner theory wherein historic designation is considered too costly for creating too much red tape.
Well, in Detroit, there are a few different places where this resistance comes from. There are neighborhoods in Detroit where the residents tend to be a little less well off. They worry about the cost of doing historically appropriate repairs to their buildings. You know, when you live in a historic district, you have to follow a certain set of standards about, you know, your window treatments or your roof or the colors that you paint your house. And people can, you know, they worry that that will lead to extra expenses for maintaining their property. You know, preservation has proven to have a long-term economic payoff. When you make an investment in the historic integrity of your neighborhood, your property values tend to stay stronger, and the quality of life in your neighborhood tends to be better. But for people who are struggling, that argument doesn't hold a lot of water in all cases. So there are individual neighborhoods in Detroit that have resisted historic designation or who are not interested in becoming historic neighborhoods. And personally, I think that's an okay choice. If your neighborhood gets together and says, you know what, we've looked at